You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
With a week of baseball season have been played, what have we learned? Really nothing. I mean, let's face it, it's just a week of the season. It's 8 games. But we did catch up with all the reporters to get the lowdown on what's going well, what's not going well, and injury updates. So let's take a listen. Ken, obviously, the Dodgers home opener, the big news, the big spotlight was really on Vin Scully. He has announced, of course, that this will be his last season, made all the stars out to honor him on the field. So I think that if you're not only a Dodgers fan, but if you're just a baseball fan and a history of baseball fan, you had to appreciate, like, Koufax, Newcomb, Valenzuela, Garvey, Lasorda, you know, all down there to pay homage to what everyone agrees is the greatest announcer in history.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's sort of bittersweet, really, when you think about it. I mean, most of us who grew up in L.A., you know, grew up listening to Vin Scully and learned a lot about baseball listening to him. So to know that this is his final season, you know, fortunately he's healthy enough to have a final season, but, you know, he's getting up there, 88, and, you know, it's the beginning of the end. They named a street after him, that the entry street to Dodger Stadium, and he's getting a lot of recognition that has long been overdue, but he's kind of been reluctant to accept it. He's allowed at this time, you know, as kind of a farewell. He doesn't really want a farewell tour, but he's sort of getting one anyway, and he's probably as adored an icon in Southern California as I can imagine in my lifetime. So, like I said, it's bittersweet to know that this is going to be his final season.
Yeah, it's sad. And I think one of the things that everyone loves about him, not only is he a great storyteller, but he has stood the test of time and maintained his delivery and his style the entire time. And he's got such a gentle way about him. And he's not – there's so much loudness today in our world with everything being thrown at us, including announcers we see on ESPN. People are all about the catchphrases. And it is kind of – when you're listening to him, it's just so soothing. Do you think that has something to do with why everyone just loves him so much?
Well, I think it's everything. You know, it's every possible reason you can come up with. You know, I think a big part of it is that because of the longevity in one place, he's generation after generation, literally, has identified the game through his eyes and his voice. And, you know, there have been announcers that have lasted a long time. Some of them moved around. But here's a guy who moved with the team from one coast to the other. And the Dodgers, who have been here since the late 50s, you know, have been totally and constantly identified as Vin Scully's team. You know, the players come and go, but he's been the one constant since they arrived. And so not only is it his delivery and the longevity and just his style, which is so pleasing to listen to, but over the years, he really has become the eyes and the ears and the voice and the face of Dodger baseball in L.A. So, you know, I guess there really isn't anybody that you can compare to him in baseball or really in any other sport.
Yeah, and just such a nice guy, too. So, well, good for him. I mean, it's nice that the fans are able to salute him and that there's a final farewell, and that's good. It's good for the Dodgers. So let's move on to what's actually going on in the field. 4-4 start, can't really make much of that either way. Certainly an acceptable start. Kenta Maeda, oh, I finally realized how to say his name. So he's been as good as they could have possibly wanted him to be. So I have to say, with all the injuries and everything that's going on with the Dodgers, that has to be a very encouraging spot for the Dodgers right now.
Well, they're happy about him for sure. You know, like you said, at least the first time through, you know, and he's faced two teams, and he's been real good both times. So he struggled a little bit against Arizona. He had a pitch out of more jams than he did out of in San Diego. But he makes pitches. He's got, you know, a variety of pitches. He's got an arsenal. And as Dave Roberts was saying after the game, because of that arsenal, he can pretty much come up with an out pitch against almost any hitter. And that's just something that isn't the case with most pitchers. So, you know, they've they've got a lot of things to be concerned about, but Maeda's not one of them.
Yeah, and another one who's, let's talk a little bit, Yasiel Puig, in a positive light. So he's hitting, and again, we're talking about a very, very short amount of time with just a week's worth of games being played, eight games. But it has to be nice. I mean, he really came out of the gate swinging. It's kind of tempered a little bit in the last series, but it's certainly good to see him holding up his end of the bargain offensively, I would think.
Yeah, you know, he's really been a model citizen all through spring training so far in the season. He's not swinging for the fences. He's taken what the pitchers give him. You know, when you do talk about these three series here, you know, the first one is against the Padres, and the Padres probably couldn't have played worse. So I don't know what to make of those three wins other than they beat the Padres. You know,
right.
They're 1-4 since leaving San Diego, and so that's a little bit more concerning. But as far as Puig goes, he's hitting cutoff men. He's running the bases properly. He hasn't really made a bad move. And you know, if the Dodgers are gonna really succeed this year, they need him to be the way he was when he was a rookie and he was really carrying this ball club. They've got a lot of other issues to be concerned about, and they can't afford to have him go bad. So far, you know, with a very small sample, he's been everything they want him to be.
Chris, before we talk about the Giants, let's talk about a little bit of news that came out, a little sad news. Speck Richardson, who was a general manager of the Giants, passed away, had a nice long life of 93 years old. What can you tell us about his time with the Giants?
Well, people shouldn't underestimate it, Allison, or overlook it, because He pulled off the Vita Blue trade in 1978. Seven players and $300,000 in cash they sent to the Oakland A's for Vita Blue. And that was definitely a quantity for quality type thing. None of those seven players really made that much of an impact with the A's, whereas Vita went on to win 18 games in his first year with the Giants.
Exactly.
And, you know, he didn't really do that. He kind of slipped later on in his career, but just that one year made a big difference because, you know, they had almost moved to Toronto 2 years previous. And with Vida, they were, you know, he won 18 games. They were in first place for more than half the season. And their attendance went up from 700,000 to 1.7 billion, which was, you know, just an absolutely staggering increase. And it helped stabilize the franchise and revitalize baseball in the San Francisco area. And, again, for those reasons, people should not underestimate what Speck Richardson did for the Giants.
So $300,000 back in 1979 was considered a lot of money.
Well, not a big deal.
It's like 70% of a major league minimum now.
I'll bet Charlie Finley, the A's owner at the time, probably could have taken care of a lot of his financial obligations with that $300,000.
Exactly. So he's a GM for the Giants and the Astros. So he's actually known around my parts as well. So rest in peace, Speck Richardson. I would hear about him a lot over time, just being around the Astros. And he seemed like he was not scared to make a big trade. In fact, I'm reading off my screen right now. So he traded Rusty Staub to Montreal for Jack Billingham, Skip Quinn, and cash considerations. He also dealt Joe Morgan, Dennis Mankey, and Cesar Geronimo, and Billingham, Cincinnati, for Lee May and others. That was a bad trade, Chris. That was a bad, bad trade.
Like you said, Speck wasn't afraid to wheel and deal. It's funny, Dean, if I remember correctly, because I'm old, the initial reviews of that Joe Morgan trade were actually, you know, favorable to the Astros, but of course it turned out, you know, Speck unwittingly turned the Reds into a powerhouse by sending them Joe Morgan.
Yes, I'd like to thank him for making my childhood in Dayton, Ohio, a lot more fun. I know my dad was a lot happier. So let's move on to the current Giants. And I was had to chuckle at this one. As we know in modern-day baseball, pitcher wins mean nothing. They mean nothing to decision-makers. Front offices are trying to explain to us why they should mean nothing to us. And Johnny Cueto's outing would be the perfect example of why pitcher wins don't matter. He gets correct me if I'm wrong, he got the win in after pitching seven innings, he had he allowed five runs in the first inning, and he faced 10 batters, and he ended up getting the win, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So that was basically a matter of his Giants getting him off the hook later.
Yes. And you pitch to the scores a lot of times.
Right.
Of course, he gave up the five runs first, but they scored. Well, the big thing in that game was the Giants scored twice in their half of the first, and immediately hit back, and it just went on and on from there.
Yeah, this is not exactly the Johnny Cueto that I am expecting to show up all season, but I still think he's going to be okay. And also, so Brandon Belt gets an extension, so they really are doing a good job of locking up their key core players. So that's a big one, 6 years, $79 million. So that's a big coup for the team, correct?
Oh, it's a coup, all right. I think there are some people who still are skeptical about whether Belt will produce, but you know what? The day after he signed that deal, he had a two-run homer to tie up that game against the Dodgers, and so if he can keep doing things like that, yeah, it'll pay off.
Yeah. So what are his top qualities that prompted them to want to sign him to this extension? I don't know much about him.
Mainly potential. Because he hasn't, his production numbers have not been that great. But in modern day terms, if you're an old school guy, you look at the deal and you slap your forehead and you say, why? But there aren't a whole lot of people who rank ahead of Brandon since 2012 as far as on base percentage. Obviously the Giants are starting to value that more and more. I mean, the only guys ahead of him in that category are guys like Joey Votto and really top elite first baseman. Brandon, I think, is something like seventh in the major leagues. These are numbers that came from Giants, by the way. In that category. he's still relatively young. He does have potential. It's just a matter of realizing it. Taking advantage of what he's got and with the skills he has, and he himself thinks that with experience he'll gain the consistency that has eluded him so far.
AJ, kind of sort of a not a shocking start to the season for the Padres, but I do want to talk about something that we have not talked about because he was not on the opening day 25-man roster, but he was called up because of an injury, Robbie Irwin. And he's a pitcher, and he had a very good outing recently. So tell us about that and how encouraged the Padres were to see this.
Yeah, he's actually had two really good outings recently. The last one against the Phillies was, he's just the picture of efficiency. Everything you want out of a starting pitcher. I think he needed 80 pitches to get through six innings and had to be removed because he gave up one run on really the only mistake he made on the whole night, which I don't even think it was a mistake. It was a changeup that was down. He said he should have thrown a fastball. But, he didn't make many mistakes, and he attacked the strike zone. So if you're a baseball fan, he's exactly the kind of pitcher you want to watch because he works quickly, and he got ahead. At one point, he was ahead in he threw strike one into 11 straight batters. So and his first outing actually came on Friday when he got called up because of a bullpen injury, and he did the exact same thing in relief. So the Padres have a couple guys who are talented pitchers who kind of tend to nibble around the strike zone. Robbie Irwin does not do that, and Brandon Morrow is coming back soon. Tyson Ross is probably coming back soon too. It'll be interesting to see. The Padres have a decision to make with Irwin, and he's only helping his case with what he's done so far.
Is there a place for him? And forgive me for not knowing the rotation as well as you do, but as far as, with guys that may not have options on a contract or are in, where would he fit in when these guys come back healthy? Is there a place where he would actually be able to, take someone else's spot who wouldn't necessarily be like somebody that they'd have to throw into waivers or anything like that?
Yeah, there's a place for him. The question is kind of who either gets sent down or sent to the bullpen to fill that place. Obviously, Erland has to keep pitching the way he's pitching. Tyson, he probably has two or three more starts before Ross and or Moro come back. So there's a place for him that may necessitate Drew Pomeranz going to the bullpen, although he looked very good in his first start. Colin Ray, he was kind of one of the example of one of the guys who has pretty good stuff, but he walks too many guys. I mean, his pitch count gets too high too fast. So if he can kind of limit that, he'll have a chance to stay in the rotation. It's interesting because we spent pretty much all of spring discussing the Padres' battle for the final two rotation spots. Well, spring ended. We thought that it ended. And now Tyson Ross's injury plus Brandon Morrow's impending return, we kind of have the exact same battle going on 2 weeks into the season.
Yeah, it is funny. Like, we put so much stress on who's going to make that roster coming out of spring training, and within a week, it's completely, you know, it can look completely different. Things happen in our game. So, okay, so there's four guys. We talked a little bit about Ross and Morrow. There's four guys that are on the mend who could be slowly making their way back. So let's start with Solarte. I guess he was out with a hammy injury. So what's his status, and when could we see him back?
So Andy Green talked, and he's just getting reports on Solarte because Solarte's back in San Diego. And he said that Solarte could be back closer to the 15-day mark than the 30-day mark. I think they had kind of expected it to be a month at first, and now they're optimistic that it's going to be less than that. So beginning of May is probably most likely. The Padres can really use his bat in the lineup, mostly because they get very right-handed heavy. John Jay and Corey Spangenberg lead off as a pair of left-handers. And that's fine because they're both on-base guys and they both have pretty even splits, but they get right-handed heavy toward the middle of the lineup. And Solarte has some left-handed power. Solarte is a switch hitter, so he can kind of break that up. Plus, he was hitting the ball really well, and I think when he went down, that was kind of the first – one of the first – I mean, he was obviously upset that he got hurt. You're upset when you get hurt whenever because you want to be out on the field. But he said, hey, it's really too bad this happened now because I was feeling really good at the plate. And he was. He was – just remember, the Padres got off to that rocky start early in the season. He was one of the few guys that was hitting the ball hard. He went down with the injury. So they really could use him to lengthen their lineup, and the sooner the better for them.
Okay, and so we talked a little bit about Ross and Morrow, but you think it'll be like another couple weeks in terms of like missed starts, another two or three before they have to make some of these decisions?
Yeah, Ross is an interesting case because everyone talked about how minor it was. He hasn't started throwing again. He hasn't started throwing again yet, so, and that should come soon. So my guess is that as soon as he starts throwing, we're going to know whether there's anything lingering or whether, hey, it's just – I mean, Ross said when he talked to the trainer about it, he figured it would just be something that, hey, get a little treatment and go out there and make your next start. And all of a sudden, obviously in April, it's never a bad idea to play cautious. Brandon Morrow could be the end of April too. Ross's first day he could come back would be April 20th. Brandon Morrow he's interesting because they're essentially not rushing him. He's got off to a late start to spring training. I mean, he was there the whole time, but he was working out. They just took it really, really slow with him, given that he's coming off shoulder surgery last August. And he pitched 5 1/3 innings last night for Class A, or 2 nights ago for Class A. So it'll be an interesting decision they have to make with him because they really, really have been taking it slowly. He was one of the Padres' best pitchers to start the season last year, and it was only for about a month and a half. But when he's on, he can be a very effective pitcher, and I think they view him as having a spot in the rotation whenever he's healthy.
We're just going to jump on that bandwagon. So Thomas, NL Player of the Week, not Rookie of the Week, Player of the Week. 7 home runs. What is going on with this guy?
I'll tell you what, it's crazy. He, as I said earlier, he's a home run machine and a pun machine. I mean, everybody has a story pun. We'll try to avoid one, but I guess they're like potato chips. You just can't control yourself. But yeah, no, this kid came in this year really just ready to play. I mean, the shortstop job wasn't really his, you know. Jose Reyes being out right now, and there's still no decision I know of on him. But Trevor Story had the opportunity to win the job, and he went out and won it. He hit 6 home runs in spring training, and we were sitting around saying, there's no way he can keep this pace up. Now look at him.
Yeah. And the thing was that he started off on the road, so it's not even like everyone's saying, oh, it's just at the Coors Field. I mean, they were away from – where did they start? San,
San Diego? Was that where they started?
They were in Arizona.
Arizona.
So he didn't have to leave Arizona. So, hey, he did hit well in Arizona. But, listen, this is legit. The guy is hitting fastballs. He's hitting sliders. He's hitting curves, and he's hitting changeups. And he's hitting them all out of the ballpark. So it's not like he's just getting a bunch of fastballs and hitting them. Now, the interesting thing about where he bats in the order, he could – I'm not going to say he's going to keep up this pace. I mean, I can't remember what the pace is for home runs, but it's way too many, and it would be a record. But here's what's happening. Charlie Blackmon right now is putting up good at bats. He's just not getting on base at the normal pace. When Charlie Blackmon is getting on base and you've got Carlos Gonzalez behind Trevor Story, this kid has a chance to continue to get pitches in the strike zone. Yet pitchers are going to test his discipline, and he has struck out a few times this year, but so what? If he swings and he knocks the ball over the fence, guess what? It's a point or two or three or four, so I don't mind him striking out every now and then.
Yeah, it is just so much fun. You know, everyone's kind of talking about it. Oh, did Story homer today? And, I mean, I guess the question is, when he settles in a little bit, you know, I mean, how does that work for somebody who had such an amazing start? I mean, obviously things are going to even out a little bit, and he can't get frustrated if he goes a while without hitting and without hitting home runs. I mean, it just kind of has to be the player that he is, right? Is that going to be more difficult
when
things start to even out?
I don't expect it to bother him that much, and this is the reason why. 2013, he hit .233 at Class A Modesto. The next year, he hit well over .300 at Modesto, repeating it. Then he goes up to Double A. Now, there was a broken finger during that year, but he went up to Double A and hit .200, okay? This kid has struggled. They have allowed him to not only do well, but also to struggle in the minors and to learn how to come back from difficult times. So it's not like this kid is just out of high school and he's been rushed through the minors and he's never had a slump. So he's going to, you know, turn into Jimbo when a slump hits.
Yeah. So, and let's talk about the Rockies in general. I mean, it's only a week's worth of games, and I get that, but they have a nice little .500 record as we're taping this. And other people have obviously contributed. So there's been some good pitching outings. Chad Bettis, tell us about him.
Chad Bettis did have one good pitching outing. I mean, it was a Sunday against the Padres after two really bad pitching outings by Jorge De La Rosa and Jordan Lyles. Pitching has shown up as a weakness because they've had two good outings this year, one by Tyler Chatwood in Arizona and the other by Bettis. Other than that, starting pitching has been a problem, as you expect it coming into the year. What's happened is DJ LeMahieu has hit close to .500. He had multi-hit games in his first five games to break Larry Walker's club record, and he's hit in every single game. He hits all throughout the lineup. He's hit first, he's hit sixth, and he's hit eighth. And that's made the offense go a bit. Carlos Gonzalez, he got off to a .375 start and hit some absolute rockets of home runs. So those things are working for the team. Nolan Arenado has not picked up batting average wise, but when he hits the ball, he's hit it hard, and he had a couple of home runs in the first week of the season. So offensively, it's the team that you expected to see. They scored six or more runs in four of the first six games. They're just going to have to pitch better from a starter perspective, because the bullpen, it struggled with some of the middle and long guys, but when you get the ball into the eighth inning or so with a lead, Miguel Castro has been lights out, okay? Every time out there, he's thrown this 97-mile-an-hour fastball and this 81-to-83-mile-an-hour slider, and hitters are confounded by it. And you've got Jake McGee in the closer role while Jason Mott gets well after a shoulder issue. They've got a pretty good late bullpen. They've got a very good offense. The starting pitching just has to pitch well consistently, and they're going to have to do a lot better than they did the first week of the season.
But we are going to talk about the Diamondbacks, who I think are the most fascinating team. Maybe not the best team, but the most fascinating team in the NL West. I'm Allison Footer, and I'm here with Steve Gilbert, who we have not talked with in a while. Steve, glad you're back. And also, let's talk about Paul Goldschmidt, first of all. So this is what I find interesting. He is really good versus the Dodgers, and that's not that unusual for like a player to have some kind of domination against a team in their division. But the Dodgers are not necessarily a team that you would think like somebody could dominate. That's why it's so impressive that in his lifetime he has a .338 batting average against these guys. I guess you can't really explain that, can you?
No, and asking him to explain it is kind of fruitless, too, because he just doesn't like to talk about himself, and he certainly doesn't like to talk about, you know, good fortune he might have against the team. It is hard to explain because the Dodgers typically have some pretty good pitchers, but, you know, he does well against good pitching. You know, he owns Tim Lincecum as well. I think he hit his first homer, if I'm not mistaken, off Matt Cain the first time he faced him. So, I mean, he seems to step his game up another level when he needs to. And as to why, I tried yesterday asking him after his, big performance against the Dodgers, you know, is there something about Dodger Stadium? Is he likes hitting at Dodgers? Is there, you know, because sometimes players are – like a hitting background in a certain place. And he said, nope, there's really no difference for him. So good luck trying to figure that one out or to get any help from him on figuring that out.
Yeah. Well, it's still fun to talk. I remember covering the Astros, Lance Berkman, like he just hit great in Cincinnati, but it wasn't just one ballpark in Cincinnati. So it was the old one and then the new one. And he had like a .450 batting average in both of those ballparks, and you just can't – I mean, I can explain that because the Reds are, like, really, really bad throughout Berkman's entire career, but still. But there's – I don't know. There's got to be something there to it. But
Could have been the chili, right?
It could have been the chili. Yeah, it could have been the fact that he didn't really like leaving Texas and he didn't like being in Cincinnati, but who really knows. Okay, so I want to talk about Shelby Miller, who is my pick to be a really good pitcher on this team, and I'm a big fan. So everyone talks about Zach Greinke, who has been underwhelming so far. I'm assuming that will turn around. But Shelby Miller, how has he been?
You know, he struggled his first outing. He gave up 6 runs, and they were all in one inning. And he seemed to do fine the other 5 innings. His last outing, his stuff actually seemed to be even better his last outing in terms of how many bats that he missed. Now he didn't get the win. He didn't pitch as well as he probably expects to pitch. But, you know, Chip Hale's been saying that sometimes it takes guys a little couple of starts to just kind of settle in a little bit with a new team. So definitely he was a guy that was my X factor for the Diamondbacks this year. So he's somebody that I'll be watching closely as well. And it's going to be interesting to see how he does in his third and fourth starts here, now that he's got a couple under his belt, and to see if he's able to make certain adjustments and how that all plays out.
Yeah, it's a long season, and I don't want to go on too much about Zach Greinke's start to the season, but it's going to be disappointing. I mean, what's been going on with him so far? Are there any worries about this?
No worries. Certainly some disappointment, and, he just terms it, you know, even though his last start was better than his first start, he just, you know, terms it as disappointing and unacceptable. Those are his words. So I don't think that they're too concerned about either one of these guys just yet because of the track records. And, you know, Chip Hale was saying that, you know, when you look at a guy who's been in the big leagues for a while, whether it's a hitter or a pitcher, and you see their numbers, typically you don't worry when they have a track record of success when they struggle initially, because they'll find a way to get back on track. So certainly they're expecting better things from Greinke, and he's expecting better things from himself. And it'll be interesting to see how he does in his next start pitching against the Padres.
Okay, and the guy I want to talk about is Socrates Brito, for two reasons. One, that's the best name I've ever heard. Not just the best name in baseball, that's just a great name. And two, how is he adjusting to all of this? He's thrust into the spotlight. Everyone's talking about him because of who he's replacing with A.J. Pollock going down, and so he seems to be the guy. How is he adjusting to that? Is he getting a lot of attention? What's it been like for him?
Well, he's my favorite name, too. And when they signed him way back when, I was thinking, man, I hope this guy gets to the big leagues because I would just be great to write Socrates on a regular basis. And then yesterday, opening day at Dodger Stadium, I was listening to, of course, Vin Scully on my MLB TV, and he gave a whole history of the philosopher Socrates during Brito's first at-bat. So that was fascinating as well. But as only Vin Scully can do. But as far as how he's handling it, he is a very mature kid. He doesn't seem to be fazed by anything. He's what the coaching staff will call the game moves slow for him, in terms of he doesn't get panicked. He doesn't ever seem overwhelmed. So it's hard to know if any of this talk about replacing A.J. Pollock impacts him at all, because he's just very quiet and very unassuming, and doesn't seem to be, you know, happy one day, sad the next day. He just seems very kind of built for baseball in terms of his mental approach, which seems to be very consistent.